From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with Isaac Asimov, the author of hundreds of books of science fiction and science fact. His latest book is Fantastic Voyage 2. Also today, I talk with Peter Wagg, the creator of Max Headroom. What started as a spot character on British television has grown into an international phenomenon, with Max Headroom now appearing in ads, in books, and starring in his own TV series. Ken Tucker says home video gives you a second chance to check out director Sam Peckinpah's last films. And singer Ian Whitcomb takes us on a trip through Tin Pan Alley. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is science and science fiction writer Isaac Asimov. When he started writing science fiction in the 1930s, he didn't expect that fantasies like space travel and nuclear power would be realities in his lifetime. Asimov's books like I, Robot and the Foundation Trilogy have made him one of America's most influential science fiction writers. This year, he was honored with a Nebula Award that named him Grand Master of Science Fiction. He's also one of our most prolific writers with 366 books under his belt. Many of those books explain scientific phenomena and offer his projections about life in the future. Asimov's latest book is Fantastic Voyage 2, a follow-up to the novelization he wrote of the 1966 film Fantastic Voyage. Isaac Asimov emigrated with his parents to America from the Soviet Union in 1923 when he was 3 years old. They settled in Brooklyn, New York. I spoke with him from the NPR Bureau in New York. We started off with his childhood. These are the science fiction magazines that first hooked him on the genre.
The very first one was Amazing Stories in 1929. I then passed on to Science Wonder Stories and Air Wonder Stories. And finally, in 1930, when a new magazine came out called Astounding Stories, I read that. In short, I read all the science fiction magazines there were.
How did you discover them?
My father had a candy store, and I discovered them on his newsstand. He wouldn't let me read the magazines, but I convinced him that science fiction dealt with science. And he let me read that, which is a good thing.
It's funny that he should be selling them but not allowing his son to read them.
Oh, that was not at all funny. I presented him with that paradox myself. And he said, well, he was not responsible for other people, but he was responsible for the welfare of his son.
Were your parents determined that you should be a doctor or a lawyer?
My father wanted me to be a doctor, and I didn't want to be, but being a obedient son, I applied to medical school, and to my great relief, I was rejected. So I went on for chemistry.
I guess the chemistry helped more on your science fiction writing and science writing than the medical degree would have.
Well, it's not that so much. It's just that medical school would have taken up all my time and I wouldn't have been able to write. So that it was not, would not have been a good idea for me to go to medical school, aside from the fact I would have hated being a doctor.
You had your first story published in 1938 in Astounding Science Fiction, which was one of the magazines that you mentioned you used to read. John Campbell was the editor then, and he was one of the most influential science fiction editors. And you worked with him for many years. What was the early advice that he gave you about your writing?
Well, I'm not sure that he gave me general advice. He would point out where I had gone wrong in specific stories. And what he told me afterwards was that he had high hopes for me because I listened to what he said and apparently took advantage and learned from what he said. Incidentally, he published my third story. My first two stories were published in Amazing Stories. They were Campbell rejects.
Oh, really?
Yes.
What was your very first story that you published?
Marooned Off Vesta. And I sold it on October 21st, 1938, and it appeared in the stands in the March 1939 issue of Amazing Stories, which hit the stands on January 9th, 1939, 1 week after my 19th birthday. So that next year I'll be celebrating my golden anniversary as a professional writer.
Were your parents impressed when you actually got into print?
Yes, they were. My father especially. He would send letters to all his friends And fortunately, he stopped after three or four had appeared.
So it would have taken a lot of letters if he wrote every time you got published.
Yes.
So what was that first story about?
It was a ship that had gone through the asteroid belt and was hit by an asteroid. And there was just a piece of it left with three men on board, and they had to get themselves down to the asteroid Vesta, which was nearby. And I made it sound as exciting as I could possibly manage. And they bought it. They paid me $64 for it.
Now, what did you base those early stories on? On actual science knowledge that you had or on other science fiction stories that you read?
Mostly on other science fiction stories. Although they got me interested in science, and I gradually learned science as a result. But science fiction was an even earlier influence.
The more you learned about science, were you able to get further away from using other science fiction as source material?
Well, I was, you know, you use other science fiction as source material from the standpoint of atmosphere and just how to write. But the science itself gave me the raw material for the plots.
What were those early science fiction magazines like? What did they look like? What kind of illustrations did they have? What was the feel of it?
Those early magazines were larger than the magazines, the science fiction magazines of nowadays. Some were actually the size of the Slicks, the Sat Evening Post, things like that. Usually they're made of cheap paper with rough edges. They paid a half cent a word to a cent a word. And the only way you could possibly make a living out of this pulp fiction was to write a great deal and quickly and without undue revision. And I learned how to do that in those days. I thought that was the way to write. I didn't know any better. And I've kept that up ever since. And so as a result, I now have published 366 books, and I'm making a good living out of it.
Well, seriously, do you think that getting paid by the word taught you to be wordy?
No, but it certainly taught me to work hard and long, because they didn't pay much by the word, so that you couldn't spend much time in polishing and in producing beautifully crafted prose. That way you starve to death. And so I learned to write quickly and under all circumstances. I couldn't wait for inspiration to hit. I couldn't wait until I had, say, 5 straight hours of peace and quiet. I had to write whenever I had 15 minutes that I could squeeze in.
How old were you when you started to be able to support yourself from your writing?
Well, it depends on what you mean by support yourself. I was able to put myself through school, through college and graduate school, on my earnings, and I was able to supplement my income during the years when I worked as a professor at Boston University School of Medicine. I still keep the title, by the way. But it wasn't until I was in my late 30s that I could look forward to actually making a good living on writing alone. So I was not an overnight success.
Science and science fiction writer Isaac Asimov is my guest, and his latest book is called Fantastic Voyage 2. It's a sequel to The Fantastic Voyage. Now, you coined the term robotics in a story that I think you wrote in 1942.
That's right. The story was called Runaround. And I had someone refer to the three laws of robotics, and that was the In fact, I think they called them three rules the first time I mentioned them. But that was the first time the word robotics was ever used in print in the English language. And I get the credit for it in the Oxford English Dictionary.
That must be a thrill.
Yeah. Two other words also I get the credit for.
Oh, really? Which ones?
One is psychohistory, which I was the first to use in my Foundation series. And the other is positronic, which I was the first to use in connection with my robots.
No, wait, what's positronic?
Well, it's the same as electronic, except instead of electrons, he used the opposite sort of particles called positrons. They were only discovered in 1934, and 5 years later I began to speak of positronic brains instead of electronic ones. And I happen to be the first one to do that. But it's a logical word. All three words are logical words, you see. If I hadn't used them, someone else would have, but I did.
Well, before we get to psychohistory, let's go back to robotics. Well, tell us how you came up with the word.
Well, I thought that was the word. You know, what's the science dealing with the study of robots, the maintenance of robots, the design of robots? Almost all the branches of physics end in ICS, physics itself, hydraulics, celestial mechanics, statics, electrodynamics. The ICS is the usual physics ending, so I figured that if you're going to deal with robots, the science is robotics.
Would you review the three rules of robotics that you came up with?
Well, I eventually called them three laws. Number one is a robot may not harm a human being or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm. Second law is a robot must obey orders given it by a human being, except where that would conflict with the first law. And the third is a robot must protect its own existence, except where that would conflict with the first or second laws.
Now, these were rules for robot designers?
That's right. And as a matter of fact, they're taken seriously. In other words, a great many of the early people who worked in robotics were more or less inspired by my robot stories, and they knew the three laws, and they realized that if they could develop robots that obeyed them, that would be great. So far, the robots we have are still extremely simple computerized levers. They're not complex enough to have the three laws built into them.
What were the robots that you envisioned in the 1940s when you were writing this story?
Well, they were typical robots that were used in science fiction. They were made of metal and they had a roughly humanoid shape. My contribution was that they were designed with safeguards. That's what the three laws were. Until my robots came in, mostly what robot stories consisted of was robots being built and then destroying their creators. It was the Frankenstein story told over and over and over and over again. And I took the attitude that robots would be machines, and that one of the chief concerns of those who built them was to make it impossible for them to do harm. That apparently struck everyone as sensible, because after my stories became popular, the old-fashioned robot stories disappeared, and the new kinds of robot stories, even when they didn't quote my laws, which, of course, they didn't like to because they were mine, they simply assumed they existed, and so did the readers.
You know, maybe we're returning to the old kind of robots again. I'm thinking of the movie RoboCop, in which the robot finally does destroy its creator.
Well, you have to understand that in general, the movies are some 50 years behind printed science fiction, so that the level of the movies we get is roughly the level of science fiction, real science fiction of the 1930s.
Let's move on to another word that you coined, and that is psychohistory. And that was in your Foundation trilogy. And it's really the science of group behavior reduced to mathematical equations.
Yes, exactly. Of course, Erik Erikson, who's a psychiatrist, invented the word psychohistory as a way of determining historical changes as affected by the psychiatric qualities of important men like Woodrow Wilson or Albert Einstein or Sigmund Freud or Adolf Hitler. And that use of the word psychohistory is more common than my use, but it was invented later.
What did you have in mind when you coined the term and the concept?
Well, I wanted to write a short story about the fall of the Galactic Empire. I just finished reading The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire the second time, and I thought I might as well adapt it to on a much larger scale to the Galactic Empire and get a story out of it. And my editor, John Campbell, was much taken with the idea and said he didn't want it wasted on a short story. He wanted it an open-ended series that would last forever, perhaps. And so I started doing that. In order to keep the series going from story to story, I was essentially writing future history. And I had to make it sufficiently different from modern history to give it that science fictional touch. And so I assumed that the time would come when there would be a science in which things could be predicted on a probabilistic or statistical basis.
Do you think that would be good if there really was such a science?
Well, I can't help but think it would be good, except that in my stories, I always have opposing views. In other words, people argue all possible ways of looking at psychohistory and deciding whether it's good or bad. So you can't really tell. I happen to feel sort of on the optimistic side. I think if we can somehow get across some of the problems that face us now, humanity has a glorious future, and that if we could use the tenets of psychohistory to guide ourselves, we might avoid a great many troubles. But on the other hand, it might create troubles. It's impossible to tell in advance.
My guest is Isaac Asimov, the science and science fiction writer, and his latest book is called Fantastic Voyage 2, Destination Brain. We're going to talk some more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Isaac Asimov is my guest. You know, for years you've really been writing more science than you have science fiction. How come?
Oh, well, until 1958, I wrote mostly science fiction. But then when Sputnik went up and everyone in the United States got scared that we were falling behind in science, I felt it was absolutely necessary for anyone who knew science and could write to try his hand at educating the American public. So I deliberately stopped writing science fiction, mostly, and started writing science books. And that went on for 21 years, and then Doubleday got tired. And they said they wanted me to go back to writing science fiction novels. And they were very persuasive. And so I wrote Foundation's Edge, which was a continuation of the old Foundation series that I'd written 30 years earlier. And it hit the bestseller list, stayed on for 25 weeks. To my intense surprise, it was my 262nd book. And until then, I thought I had a perfect score, you know, that I knew exactly how to miss the bestseller list. I'd done it 261 times in a row, and flopping on the 262nd surprised me. But after that, Doubleday wouldn't be stopped. They wanted a novel every year, and I've been writing them, and they've been doing very, very well, I'm glad to say. Because they're hard to do.
Had you lost your interest in science fiction during that hiatus?
No, not at all. But I had thought that the field had gotten beyond me. You know, it's a rapidly developing field, and the science fiction that's written today isn't at all like the science fiction I wrote in my time. And I felt that I was just a quaint hangover from a previous generation, and that it would show. And I didn't make any effort to write in the 80s fashion, let us say. They wanted another Foundation book. I wrote it exactly as I wrote my Foundation books in the 1940s. And it seemed to go well. So I continued writing in my way, regardless of any changes that had taken place. And there seemed to be enough people who are willing to read my stuff, written in its way, for it to be reasonably successful. So I'm happy.
What are the changes that have taken place in the science fiction genre that you're referring to?
Well, for one thing, they've gone away from, for the most part, there are always exceptions, but they've moved away from being preoccupied with science and technological advance and moved in the direction of social effects. That's content. And then stylistically, things are much freer now. You can be much more realistic. You can make use of words you weren't allowed to make use of in my day. You could describe actions that you weren't allowed to describe in my day, and so on. And as a matter of fact, it's now terribly passé not to do that sort of thing. And so in my last few books, just as an experiment, I wiped out all vulgarisms whatsoever, even hells and dams, you know. I just didn't use them. I wanted to see if I would get letters telling me that, hey, there isn't a single expletive anywhere in your books. That's not real. That's not the way people speak. I never got a single letter to that effect, not one. Nobody seemed to notice. So I figured, well, what the heck? Why bother sticking in all that stuff when it doesn't come natural to me?
Your new book is a sequel to Fantastic Voyage. You wrote the novelization of the movie. And in the new book, a team of scientists miniaturize themselves to travel to the brain of a Soviet scientist who has many, many secrets that they want to unravel. Why did you want to do a Fantastic Voyage 2?
Well, you see, it's not exactly a sequel. What happened was Fantastic Voyage, the first book, was a movie. And they came to me with a movie script and asked if I would novelize it. And I did, for a small, flat sum, largely because I'd never done anything of the sort. And it took me only 6 weeks to do it. And it was turned out to be a huge success, quite independent of the movie. Usually these movie throwaway things, once the movie's through, they're thrown away. But this one, it's still in print, both in hardcover and in softcover, and still selling more than 20 years after the movie had its play. But I never was really happy with it because it hadn't been my own imagination. I took it from the movie. And what's more, I couldn't write any more on the subject because the story belonged to the movie people. And then someone bought the rights to the title. Only the title, not the characters, not the events. Only the title. And they came to me and asked me to write Fantastic Voyage 2. And eventually I agreed. And this time I made use of my own imagination. I told a story of submarines inside the human body as I wanted to tell it. And whether that makes it better or worse, I'll leave it for others to decide. But I was much happier with the second one.
Well, in Fantastic Voyage 2, the destination is the brain. I think it's fair to say that you've been pretty obsessed with the brain over the years. You've written a lot of science books and science essays about the brain. And I think, is it fair to say that that's the organ of the body that interests you most?
Well, in a way, yes. In the first place, that's the way I make my living. I mean, I use my brain such as it is. And in the second place, it is at once the most hopeful and the most dangerous part of the human body. Most hopeful because solutions to problems arise from the human brain, and the most dangerous because the problems themselves also arise from the human brain. It's the thoughts, the ideas, the genius that solve the problems, but it's our tendency towards hatreds and fears and suspicions that create the problems. And we don't know how the brain works. So that naturally makes it all the more interesting.
I think a lot of people live in fear as they get older that the power of their brain is going to diminish with age. Is that something that you've worried about?
No, you can't help but worry about such things. After all, I've depended all my life on a rather remarkable memory. So I don't take notes. I don't keep cross-filed indexes or anything. Everything gets piled into my head and stays there. And I call it up whenever I need it. And I know that as one gets older and older, that the brain, like any other part of the body, gradually deteriorates. And so I keep waiting for my memory to start going. It's a frightening thing. Every time I can't think of a word, I say, oh, there it goes. But so far it's managing. I am now 67, and I'm still going along full speed. How much longer I can manage, I don't know. But every added day is a day of glory for me.
You know, your book Fantastic Voyage reminded me in a way of an essay that you wrote a few years ago about a triple heart bypass that you had. And in that essay, you described having an angiogram, which is where they basically inject dye into an artery so that they could monitor the flow of blood through the heart. And you had the option of watching the angiogram on the video screen that your heart was being monitored on, but you wrote that you turned your head and you didn't want to watch it.
No, I didn't.
For the author of Fantastic Voyage, describing all these scientists journeying through the body's bloodstream, I thought that was pretty interesting.
Well, I hadn't thought of that, but, you know, it's like that old statement saying that the management is not responsible for the views expressed in this program. Well, I'm the management, and I'm not responsible for the views presented in my stories. I travel all over the galaxy. In real life, I hate to travel, and I never go in airplanes. When I wrote a book called The Human Body, I described every conceivable disease and bad working that I could think of without a shudder. But in real life, I'm very queasy.
Well, what made you turn your head from that video?
I didn't want to see anything probing through my blood vessels to my heart. It just didn't strike me as an aesthetic experience.
Well, now we could get to your fear of planes. For someone who wrote about a spacewalk before astronauts actually landed on the moon, yet you were afraid to fly planes. That's quite a paradox.
Well, I'm not sure that I'm afraid to fly them. I just
don't trust
never
them.
Got into the habit of it, that's all. And now it's too late. I just don't want to. But that's part of a bigger problem. I just hate to travel by any means. I like to stay where I am. I never leave Manhattan voluntarily. And I don't know why that is. When I'm forced to travel, it doesn't bother me very much. It's just that I happen to like it at home.
You once wrote that we should not see science or technology as inevitable destroyers or saviors. Does that kind of sum up your view of technology?
That's right. It's technology is neutral. That is, it depends on how it's used. It's up to us to use it wisely or foolishly. And often our intentness on immediate gain, on short-term goals, causes us to use it foolishly without due regard for the long-term harm we might do. And that's sad, of course, but on the other hand, it's understandable. It's very difficult for human beings to take the long view and to give up the immediate profit.
With that said, are there any breakthroughs or inventions that you really would like to see happen?
Oh, I want to see how. I want to have people find out just how the brain works. And that, to me, is the most important conceivable problem to be solved in the world. And on a lesser scale, I would like to see a space-centered society. I want to see the human range extended. I want to see mining stations on the moon and huge settlements in orbit around the Earth. I would like to see power plants in orbit and factories. I would like to see as much as possible of Earth's industrial plant moved into space so that we don't foul our own nest with waste products. Of course, people say, well, then we'll just foul space. But space is much larger. And space has an automatic cleaning device called the solar wind, so that things might be better up there. Oddly enough, the pollution of space is not so much the ordinary chemical wastes and all that. It's the fragments of satellites that are beginning to worry people, because they stay in orbit. Billions and countless billions of little particles, sometimes just of paint, which are moving around at 5 miles a second, and which, when they strike, can do damage, even when they're very light. So we're going to have to figure out ways of sweeping up space, for instance.
If there were space colonies in your lifetime, would you dare to travel to them?
No, not me. Not me, but someone has to stay on Earth, and I volunteer.
Isaac Asimov, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
My guest has been science and science fiction writer Isaac Asimov, whose latest book is a science fiction book called Fantastic Voyage 2, Destination Brain, and it's just been published by Doubleday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Clarence Kelly, who succeeded J. Edgar Hoover as director of the FBI. He's written a memoir about his years in the FBI, so I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, Peter Wagg, the creator of Max Headroom, talks about life with TV's first computer-generated leading man. Also, singer Ian Whitcomb performs Tin Pan Alley songs that celebrate technology. And critic Ken Tucker reviews the home video releases of director Sam Peckinpah's last two movies, Convoy and The Osterman Weekend. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Ann Bozell in Washington. Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger says the United States will destroy the Iranian ship it caught laying mines in the Persian Gulf on Monday. He also warned that the U.S. would destroy any other mine-laying equipment found by U.S. forces. Weinberger made the comments on board the USS La Salle in the Persian Gulf, where he met with the ship's commanders and crew. Jesse Shulman reports.
When Weinberger spoke to the men of the USS La Salle, one of the first questions was about money. Why were they being taxed on their danger pay?
That's not my department. That's the Treasury. He wanted to know why the imminent pay is taxed, and I don't think it should be.
Weinberger also took a swipe at Congress for cutting President Reagan's defense requests and declined to promise that the men here would be home for Christmas. This is Jesse Shulman with the Middle East Task Force in the Gulf.
Vice President George Bush thanked the Italian government today for its support of U.S. military operations in the Persian Gulf. Italy recently sent 8 naval vessels to the Gulf. After meeting in Rome with the Italian prime minister, Bush told reporters that the Italians expressed genuine enthusiasm over the prospect of a superpower arms control agreement. Bush is on a 9-day diplomatic mission to Western Europe and Poland. Two former presidents of the American Bar Association took the stand today against the nomination of Judge Robert Bork to the Supreme Court. Chesterfield Smith told the Senate Judiciary Committee that Bork's confirmation would upset the balance of the high court. Robert Meserve accused Bork of intellectual nitpicking and said the nominee would turn back the clock.
Your committee, if it were to approve this appointment, would in fact be establishing for a long time a majority on the Supreme Court, which will carry that court, which we all revere, in the opposite direction from that in which it has been going during the period of which I am so proud.
Bork's record on civil rights was defended today by black conservative economist Thomas Sowell.
All the things Mr. Bork has done to advance the civil rights of blacks and Asians are either ignored or played down.
Sowell is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. Disputing the earlier testimony of civil rights leaders, Sowell maintained that Bork's record has been distorted. A third week of hearings is scheduled to open on Monday. A Missouri teenager went on a shooting spree today, killing his parents, three brothers, and an aunt before he was killed in a struggle with an uncle. Authorities in Webster County, Missouri, say they don't know what caused 15-year-old Kirk Buchner to begin shooting. They say he apparently killed his parents and brothers at their home and then drove about 5 miles to the home of his aunt and uncle. There, he shot his aunt before being killed in a struggle with his uncle. The uncle is being treated for stomach wounds at a Springfield hospital. An investigation is continuing. Academy Award-winning actress Mary Astor died today in California. UPI's Bob Fuss has details.
Mary Astor, a big star in the era of silent movies, who had a second career as a character actress, made more than 100 films during her long stint in Hollywood. She died in her sleep at the Motion Picture Country House Hospital in the suburbs of Los Angeles. Mary Astor got her first movie contract in 1920 and leaped to stardom opposite John Barrymore in Beau Brummel. She starred in a host of silent films and early talkies, including a role opposite Humphrey Bogart in The Maltese Falcon. Later in life, she played character roles, finally winning an Oscar in 1972 as Best Supporting Actress in The Great Lie. She also wrote six novels. Her life was like a movie itself. She had a long love affair with John Barrymore, had four marriages, lost all her money and attempted suicide, and was involved in a multitude of Hollywood scandals. Her last years were spent in declining health at the motion picture home, where she says she used to watch her old films. Bob Fuss, Los Angeles.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up nearly 4 points to end the week at 2570.17. This is NPR. I'm Ann Bozell in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Once a week, we invite a musician to share their talents with us. Our guest performer today is Ian Whitcomb. You may remember his rock novelty hit, You Turn Me On, that made it to number 8 on the charts in 1965. But his specialty is the history of American and British pop music. He's the author of After the Ball, A History of Pop from Ragtime to Rock and Roll. Whitcomb grew up in England and now lives in California. He wishes today's songs were as topical as some of those from the turn of the century, like this one about the telephone, Hello, My Baby.
Hello, my baby, hello, my honey, hello, my ragtime gal. Send me a kiss by wire, mom, honey, my heart's on fire. If you refuse me, honey, you'll lose me, then you'll be left alone. So baby, telephone and tell me I'm your own.
These days, we don't seem to hear any pop songs about current events, about people in the news, latest inventions. I mean, have you heard any songs lately about Iran or Reagan or Gorbachev, or even compact discs? But you know, back in the early years of this century, when the popular music business was young, and the song, and I mean the song alone, was king, real life was constantly being harped upon. For example, in 1915, while Europe was locked in World War I and America remained neutral, President Wilson was urged to hitch his wagon to ragtime. And here's a song about it.
We're going to celebrate the end of war in ragtime. Be sure that Woodrow Wilson leads the band.
The sinking of the Titanic had been the subject of many a doleful ballad. And then there were new inventions, like, for example, the aeroplane.
Come Josephine in my flying machine, going up she goes.
And the automobile.
Come away with me, Lucille, in my merry Oldsmobile.
You see, popular songs could be, in effect, musical newspapers. Indeed, one of the fathers of the song industry, a man called Charles K. Harris, although he used to like to call himself Chaz K. Harris, advised fledgling songwriters to always look at the newspapers for your storyline. But in 1915, the American press was having one of its periodic flaps about immigrants. You see, they were depicted as invading foreign hordes, infesting the streets, shouting babble, wearing funny wooden shoes, and it was said, terrible and unfamiliar smells exuded from their kitchens. But also in 1915, there were new and threatening elements. Old Europe was fighting in World War I, fighting for democracy. And in the New World, people feared, socialism, groups like the Wobblies, was threatening to topple the Republic. The press clamour grew shrill. They said these immigrants were anti-American, and they didn't know the good old songs like On the Banks of the Wabash Far Away, and they couldn't sing along to I'm a Yankee Doodle Dandy. And so the songsmiths of Tin Pan Alley responded, and they came out with songs like Don't Bite the Hand That's Feeding You.
If you don't like your Uncle Sammy, then go back to your home across the sea, to the place from where you came, whatever be its name, but don't be ungrateful to me. If you don't like the stars in Old Glory, if you don't like the red, white and blue, then don't act like the cur in the story. Don't bite the hand that's feeding you.
And then a rousing patriotic number called America, I Love You. Now, the words to this extraordinary song from 1915 were by Edgar Leslie And the tune, with its rather, I think, Russian-esque, rather melancholy melody lines, was by Archie Gottler, who was of Russian ancestry, interestingly enough. Here it is. It was quite a hit in its time. America, I Love You.
A midfields of clover, 'twas just a little over 100 years ago. A handful of strangers, they faced many dangers to make their country grow. It's now quite a nation, a wondrous population, and free from any king. It's your land, it's my land, a real do or die land, and that's just why I sing, yeah, yeah, yeah. America, I love you. You're like a sweetheart of mine. From ocean, to you my devotion is crossing each boundary line. Just like a little baby climbing its mother's knee. America, I love you, and there's 100 million others like me.
Well, the songwriters needn't have worried. The Republic survived. American doughboys helped make the world safe for democracy in World War I. In fact, 20% of these Yankee soldiers had actually been born in Europe, and the immigrants soon became worthy American citizens. By 1923, many of them could sing gladly and loudly in firm American tones the very latest Tin Pan Alley hit that was currently sweeping America. Yes! We have no bananas. We have no bananas today. But that's another story.
Ian Whitcomb performed from the studios of KCRW in Santa Monica, where he hosts a weekly pop music show. He's just finished a book about Irving Berlin.
La la la, la la la. La la la, la la la, la la la. La 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 la, la la la, la 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 la.
You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is Peter Wagg. He developed the computer-generated TV character Max Headroom and is executive producer of the Max Headroom TV series. The series ran for 6 episodes last season and returns this season. The show is set 20 minutes into the future in a post-apocalyptic world ruled by technology and controlled by a media conglomerate known as Network 23. The show uses a variety of computer-generated video graphics to achieve its quick-paced style. The show stars Matt Frewer as Edison Carter, an investigative reporter for the network. He's also the face and voice of Carter's video alter ego, Max Headroom. The show also features Amanda Pays as Theora, his editor and controller, Jeffrey Tambor as Murray, Edison's producer, and Chris Young as Bryce Lynch, a computer whiz kid. Peter Wagg brought Max here from England. I asked him how it all began.
Max was the result of Andy Park, the commissioning editor for music at Channel 4 Television in England, asking me to develop a rock video clip series. This was going back, I guess, now about 6 years prior to MTV, and I was heavily involved in rock video production as head of creative services of Chrysalis Records. So we then conceived the idea for Max as a computer-generated linking device between rock video clips. That then developed when Andy kept provoking us to come back with, why is he called Max Headroom? Where does he come from? Why does he say the things he says? And then the whole thing took shape, and the Max story was scripted, and Max himself became much more than a linking device, and was clearly from day one, even when it was the apple in our eyes, had a lot more depth and a lot more potential than simply being a talking head between videos.
What did he represent to you as a totally computer-generated video image, a real television creation?
What he represents really is the first truly created contemporary character for a new generation. Clearly there's a computer-literate society now growing up, and Max is the first character that's been created for them. Not since really Walt Disney created his characters has another one come along that has appealed so directly to the, you know, the true motivations and feelings of the current generation.
Hi. No, this is not a blipbird. This is Max Headroom on Network 23. And I know that right now you're looking at me and you're thinking, wow, he could become a star. So before you get the wrong idea about me, let me just say very humbly, you're right, I could.
Did you cast Max Frewer in the role of Max Headroom?
Yes, I did.
What were you looking for in the right actor?
Well, essentially, a kind of mid-Atlantic personality, because Max was always intended to be a truly international celebrity. So, in casting all of the American actors in England, and Matt was just completely... He stood out completely from everybody else. His sense of humour, his wit, his style, his look, everything about him really made it clear that there was nobody else in the running.
You've created a world where life is ruled by television, television is run by a very corrupt network, and the network's only motivation is ratings. A very cynical view of television. How does this go over with the network executives who buy the show and run it?
Well, the network love it. It's full of parody and satire and truth. I mean, Brandon Stoddard, who's the president of ABC, always says to me he's never happier than when Standards and Practices are on the phone to him saying the Max people are causing trouble again. It goes down very well. They like it, and you know, they have always encouraged us to just go for it.
The Max Headroom Show makes fun of ratings and makes fun of networks that are slaves to ratings. But I bet you had to watch the ratings pretty closely last season when Max Headroom premiered on American television.
Oh, well, we're exactly the same. This is the total irony of the show. We live by ratings ourselves. If we don't get the ratings, then we'll be off air. And when we know we're going off air, we'll probably write the definitive Max script that will be our swan song. last season it was every morning at 7 o'clock phoning up ABC for the overnights and then the nationals. And of course it's analysing the figures. It's the next day. It's what can we do? Where do we go wrong? Are we going wrong? Should we ignore it? Should we carry on? But the moment I allow myself to get into the ratings loop is the moment you totally lose sight of all your objectives. So you have to, as difficult as it is, sort of ignore them as a producer. Take on board constructive comments about the show itself and where it's working, where it isn't, but basically maintain the brief that you set out with, because otherwise, you'd be getting Kenny Loggins to do the soundtrack. You'd be getting Charlton Heston to guest star in it. And before you know where you'd have Edison getting into bed with Theora by the second week, and you completely lose everything.
In part because you use a lot of computer-generated graphics and a lot of visual techniques to tell the story. It's a television show that you have to watch and you can't just listen to. And I say that as someone who listens to a lot of television and doesn't always get to actually give it my full visual attention. Are you very aware of that? Because I believe that a lot of people actually listen to television and don't really watch it.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully what Max is doing is providing an alternative and something new and something different. If you look at American television in general, it's just very bland, very predictable, and very formula. And it works very well for the American audience. But that's basically all they've ever been given. It's just my feeling that there has to be a place for Max, like there has to be a place for Dallas and Wheel of Fortune. And hopefully Max just opens up a doorway for something new, fresh and different. And in doing that, it obviously is challenging both to us as producers, to the network, to have the, if you like, the confidence and the belief and commitment in the show to stay with it until such times as the audience begins to tune in and really understand it. Because once they do understand it and get inside the world, then, you know, that's when it will really kind of take off. And it just takes a bit of patience, just like Moonlighting did, just like Hill Street Blues did. It's a challenge, and people either respond to it or they go back to what they've always had before and take the easy way out.
There's a lot of computer technology on your show. Do you know much about computers, or are you comfortable with them?
I'm uncomfortable with them, and I know very little about them, because I think there has to be somebody on this project that feels that way, because a lot of other people feel that way. Obviously, within the writing team, within the whole crew, there's a very strong knowledge in this area, and I'm basically behave like Murray, the character in the series, who you often hear him say, "Yes, but what's the story?" or "Bryce, can you please tell me in English what you're saying?" or "What's the point?" or whatever. That's basically me.
Do you think that it cheapens the Max Headroom character to have him doing the Coke commercials? Because after all, the character is in a way making fun of commercials and commercialism. And you've had him be a spokesperson for mm-hmm. Coke for several years now. Does it cheapen what you're trying to do?
Well, I hope not. I mean, obviously, Max is this parody of all of the quintessential international TV personality. If you were to dial into a computer all the characteristics of, like, a Johnny Carson or a David Letterman or whoever it might be, even a Ronald Reagan or a Dustin Hoffman, the basic idea is that the computer would analyse all those appeal points and come out with an image. And our suggestion is that that image is actually Max. The fact we give him an arrogance and the fact that he says whatever he wants to say gives him, you know, that extra dimension.
Do you get a lot of strange offers for using Max Headroom
yes.
spokesperson for other other commercials or products?
We had a good one last week, which was somebody wanted to make Max condoms.
Peter Wegg is the executive producer of the Max Headroom TV series. He spoke to us from his office at Lorimar Studios in Los Angeles. By the way, they turned down the condom offer. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What stories are you following?
We're following Secretary Schultz's press conference in New York that we've heard about. Also, more on the Bork hearings and a report from Tom Gelton on how the ruling party, the PRI, the ruling Mexican political party, is trying to reform itself. We'll also be talking to Sovietologist Jerry Huff about the recent absence from public view of Soviet party chief Mikhail Gorbachev. Huff, by the way, says nothing unusual, no need to worry. He accepts the explanation that Gorbachev is simply on vacation.
Okay, well, thank you, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The late director Sam Peckinpah made films notorious for their dramatic, explosive violence. Two of Peckinpah's movies, Convoy and The Osterman Weekend, are now available on video cassette. If you've avoided Peckinpah's work in the past, our critic Ken Tucker says these two videos are worth checking out.
Chances are, when you think of the late director Sam Peckinpah, one or two film titles pop into your mind. The Wild Bunch or Straw Dogs. Controversial films from about 15 years ago that, at the time, defined the limits of both pop cinema technique and violent machismo. Right now, Peckinpah is an unfashionable figure. It's taken for granted that the last few movies he directed, commercial bombs all, were worthless junk. But one of the virtues of the home video revolution is that you don't have to trust fussy old film critics. You can make up your own mind about these things by screening the movies yourself. For example, Peckinpah's last two films, Convoy and The Osterman Weekend, are now available on video cassette, and while neither is a masterpiece, they have considerable virtues. It's easy to understand why Convoy was pummeled when it first came out in 1978. Kris Kristofferson starred as a truck driver whose CB radio handle was Rubber Duck, and his love interest was Ally McGraw. Given these two alarmingly stiff actors, it's amazing that Peckinpah managed to pull off the quite funny, often exciting movie he did. He accomplished this through a further refinement of the slow-motion action scenes he developed in his Wild Bunch period. The high point of Convoy is a series of impossibly beautiful shots of 18-wheel trucks shimmering in the desert sun. In 1983, Peckinpah released The Osterman Weekend, gleefully ripping up a Robert Ludlum novel for his source material. Peckinpah boiled down Ludlum's stilted dialogue to speech that is nearly abstract, as in this choice morsel from co-stars John Hurd and Rutger Hauer.
Are you expecting house guests this weekend? Joe and Betty Cardone, Richard and Virginia Tremaine, Bernard Osterman? The men were from your graduating class at Berkeley. This is the seventh such reunion, events known among you as Ostermans, in honor of their original sponsor. Now, these people represent a grave threat to the security of the United States of America.
Uh-huh.
It's my job to convince you of the truth of these allegations. We could arrest all of the conspirators now, but it would be more helpful to the interests of the nation if we could have your assistance over the coming weekend.
What the hell are you talking about? You could arrest who? For what?
If, after I presented you with the initial evidence, you're not convinced, then of course you may go. Keeping your mouth shut, of course.
The strength of The Osterman Weekend lies not in its convoluted plot, but in its action sequences, and in particular a virtuoso climax involving an old-fashioned crossbow used for silent, bloody killing. The accessibility of Sam Peckinpah's work on video cassette allows anyone to rediscover the underrated skills of this original American director. After the gore and gasoline of these two films, you might also want to check out Junior Bonner and Ride the High Country, which show the gentler, contemplative side of Peckinpah. Other new video cassette releases include Woody Allen's Radio Days, Marlena, Maximilian Schell's documentary about Marlena Dietrich, and A Prairie Home Companion, The Final Show.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's what's coming up on the next Fresh Air. Next time I'll speak with Gordon Lish, one of American literature's leading editors and leading scouts of new young writers. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review Keeper of the Drums, the new album by drummer Marvin Smitty Smith. And television critic David Bianculli will review the new ABC series 30-something. So I hope you can join us. And we'd like to hear from you. Write us with your comments and suggestions. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.